Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Doesn't sound like a bad thing. At least the very first two sound fantastic. Freedom and democracy. We believe in that kind of stuff. There is a crisis now. If you look at a world map, you'll see how many countries are dominated by Islam. One of the places where it dominates and has gone back and forth between a secular Islamic government and a religious Islamic government is, of course, Iran. Now, there are voices there calling for freedom and democracy, and they're also calling for a return to secularism. Now, before you jump on that and say, well, secularism's got to be better than Islam, maybe we should look at the history of that combination, the track record of that combination. Joining us to do that, Dr. Hunter Baker. He's Associate Dean of Arts and Sciences at Union University, author of the book The End of Secularism, and a forthcoming publication titled Political Thought, A Student's Guide. He's also written an article for the latest Touchstone magazine titled The Soul of Liberty, Calls for Freedom, Democracy, and Secularism End Up with None of the Above. Dr. Baker, welcome back.
Hi there. Happy to be here.
What has been the track record of that particular combination in history, freedom, democracy, and secularism?
Well, it's not nearly as good as people might think. I've noticed that these Iranian students are kind of asking for this, hoping for this, and you can sort of understand it because they live under a suffocating version of sort of Islamic theocracy. But you cannot, secularism does not sort of automatically go with freedom and democracy. I think these students think that. I think probably a lot of American kids think that. But if we want to kind of look at the track record of secularism, first of all, I think you probably would look to the French Revolution. In fact, to me, the great comparison is kind of between the French and American Revolution. Maybe we'll talk about that more. But the French Revolution is a secularizing revolution. The intent is to sort of overthrow the throne and the altar, right? You know, there's a reason why they're enthroning Goddess Reason in Notre Dame. The idea being that we're going to have done with all this Christian religion and have a new, better secular society. And of course, the French Revolution ultimately is a disaster, a bloody disaster. But besides that, I think that you look at other revolutions that I think are sort of inspired by the French Revolution or sort of fit in that line. And I would look at the Russian Revolution. I would look at the revolution in Vietnam. I would look at the revolution in Cuba, the Chinese Revolution. Those, to me, are all secular revolutions, and they don't turn out all that well.
The French Revolution in particular did champion democracy, but it became, I think by anyone's accounting, it became a new kind of tyranny. Talk about how easily democracy, apart from, what shall we say, well, just to put it simply, a Christian worldview that recognizes something objective outside man and his own reason, how democracy so easily slips into a new kind of bloody tyranny.
Well, that's right. I mean, if first of all, if you want to look at kind of ancient political thinkers, one of the types of government that they fear the most is mob rule. The counterpart of mob rule, the positive side of mob rule, is democracy. And democracy is mob rule that is constrained. That there's an anchor there, you know, some sort of a constitutionalism or something along those lines. It happens to be, if we look at the historical record, that Christianity proves to be a pretty good anchor, pretty good foundation. But if you don't have that sort of anchoring truth or that foundation, then democracy is like other forms of government. It degenerates into just being a contest of power. And that's sort of what happens with the French Revolution, is you have this increasingly contentious contest for power. Power ultimately ends up in the hands of a few people, and even they end up kind of killing each other.
Now, let's compare the two. You suggested earlier they are contemporaneous with one another.
Yes.
But they have some, and they do have some similarities, in particular in some of the initial rhetoric, but some stark differences.
That's
in
right.
The results and in the means and the methods. Compare the French Revolution and its concurrent cousin, if you will, the American Revolution.
Sure. The American Revolution, of course, happens first. Not by much, but it happens first. And the American Revolution is a revolution only against the throne. The American Revolution is not a de-Christianizing revolution. You know, you don't have the characters like in France. You have Denis Diderot talking about how he wants to strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. The Americans aren't really thinking quite that way. You have a lot of Americans, a lot of kind of northeastern clergy, the old Bible Belt in New England. They're very enthusiastic about the revolution. It's much more of a revolution kind of the people and of the sort of the American churches against the throne. Whereas in France, it's a very different kind of a thing. It's ostensibly a revolution on behalf of the people against the king and the church. Very, very much a de-Christianizing revolution. You know, they renamed something like 1,400 streets and monuments to do away with the Christian influence. You know, they even kind of tried to come up with their own civil religion to replace Christianity. So, and the interesting thing is that at first, the Americans are kind of enthusiastic about the French Revolution. You know, they've been friendly with France. They're thinking that this may be a similar revolution to their own. But over time, they begin to realize that this revolution in France, this is not only an anti-Catholic revolution. This is, in fact, an anti-Christian revolution. And the American support really begins to kind of bleed away fairly quickly.
Why is it that in the French Revolution, the primary tool for revolution was the guillotine, whereas in the United States, the primary tool of the revolution, there was bloodshed there, too. I mean, there was armed conflict. Of a different nature, but why in America was the primary tool the pen?
Well, it's an interesting question. I honestly haven't thought about that. I mean, I think the French Revolution had its own intellectuals, certainly inspired by people like Rousseau or Voltaire. Neither of them violent people, but I think that the reason the French Revolution degenerates into violence is that there's no kind of ultimate foundation there. There's no sort of moral foundation that can undergird the whole enterprise, and it just becomes a contest for power. And if power is where you're at, the easiest way to get power is through violence. I mean, that's the easiest way to resolve any conflict, right? Is not through argument, but through violence, and that's what they resorted to repeatedly.
Is part of it also that it was they were distinctly Christian thinkers who were penning the rationale for an American revolution? That there was, in the course of that, a genuine, it wasn't ideal, but it was a genuine debate in America.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that, you know, one of the interesting things to talk about is the degree to which Christianity is important in the American Revolution, the American founding. And, you know, you kind of have, I view it as sort of two extremes. You have one side that I would read about in graduate school arguing for kind of the godless constitution or the godless founding, and that, you know, that all the characters in the founding are these deists or skeptics, kind of along the lines of Thomas Jefferson. And then on the other hand, you have kind of maybe like David Barton arguing that kind of almost everybody, even Jefferson, is a Christian. And the reality is you have lots of different types of people, but it's almost an ideal marriage of kind of strong Christian type characters in the revolution, as well as people who are less so, such as Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin. And it just happens that it's kind of this beautiful fusion at a moment in time. One thing that I think is kind of worrisome about the modern day is that kind of agreement about freedom between Christians and maybe the more Enlightenment types is really beginning to fray and fall apart.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about Islam, freedom, democracy, and secularism. Dr. Hunter Baker is our guest. I invite your questions and comments. We are coming to you live this Tuesday afternoon. It's the 22nd of May, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at @issuesetc. Dr. Hunter Baker is Associate Dean of Arts and Sciences at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. He's author of the book The End of Secularism and a forthcoming book titled Political Thought, A Student's Guide. He's also written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled The Soul of Liberty, Calls for Freedom, Democracy, and Secularism End Up with None of the Above. Stay tuned. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Christ Lutheran, Jackson, Mississippi. Prince of Peace Lutheran, San Diego, California. Trinity Lutheran, Tryon, North Carolina. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Dallas, Texas. Calvary Lutheran, Yuma, Arizona. St. Paul Lutheran, Milford Center, Ohio. Peace Lutheran, Chehalis, Washington. Christ Lutheran, Noblesville, Indiana. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Lexington, Kentucky. And St. James Lutheran, Baltimore, Maryland. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a recording of an Easter and Ascension sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Pentecost Sunday, May 27th, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Easter and Ascension sermons. Now, when you make your gift, please indicate whether you want a downloadable version or a CD of these sermons. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us during the Easter season.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The difference between Planned Parenthood then and now.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, was widely known as a supporter of eugenics. She openly held that abortion could only result in a cleaner race. The organization she founded continues to be by far the largest abortion provider in America. But as Ken Connor of the Center for a Just Society has argued, there is one major difference between Planned Parenthood then and now. Margaret Sanger was brutally honest about her disregard for the unborn, while contemporary abortion advocates hide behind the language of choice in order to disguise the ugly reality of what they advocate.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
St. Michael's Singers with the Ascension hymn, Hail the Day That Sees Him Rise. That's what's playing right now at Lutheran Public Radio. And anytime, day or night, 24/7, through the Easter season, you can hear sacred music for the world and for the Easter and Ascension seasons at LutheranPublicRadio.org. It's absolutely free, and it's there for you 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org. We're talking about Islam, freedom, democracy, and secularism. Dr. Hunter Baker is our guest. Dr. Baker, before you were talking about Jefferson and Franklin in particular, and I wonder, in your assessment, unlike the intellectuals that fueled the French Revolution, these two men seemed, as secular as both of them were, and there's very little argument there, they both seemed to be smart enough to realize that they couldn't jettison the baggage of Christianity. In particular, the notions of kind of you can't trust the mob, that man is in some sense depraved, and that Christianity, at least a Christian worldview, perhaps provided the best foundation for human rights. What are your thoughts?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that with regard to Jefferson, I think he was probably satisfied that that if we had religious freedom, then the right outcome would occur. And, you know, for him, he sort of thought that, well, as long as we have religious freedom, probably within my lifetime, every young man will be a Unitarian. you know, something along those lines, a bad prediction. Franklin, I think, is probably a little bit of a different case. I think that Franklin probably had a great appreciation for the positive effects of Christianity. Franklin, of course, was a great friend of George Whitefield. So I think that while he himself may have been, a little bit on the kind of the secular mindset, I think he also had a great appreciation for the role of Christianity in the American Republic.
What about that notion of a fallen mankind that needs constraints on freedom, that requires not just philosophical, but transcendent foundations for something like freedom and liberty?
Yeah, to me, that's the whole ball game. I mean, the sort of that Christian anthropology. I think that's everything, because in the European context, what's happening is you have these constant battles over who has the power, right? Popes and kings are battling for the power. Kings and kings are battling for the power. And then as you have this democratic movement, kings versus the people or kings versus revolutionaries, who has the power? That's the big question. But with the American context, they ask a different question. They do not say, who has the power? Okay, let's use it. Instead, the Americans are saying, how much power? How much power is acceptable? And they're the ones who really start to limit power. And I think that's kind of the great innovation of the American Constitution, is that it limits power. It just ratchets it down. There's so much frustration with the way the American government works and how slow it is and how hard it is to affect change. But that is all by design. I tell my students that our government works like an engine with sand in its gears. You know, it clutches and it crashes, but it's meant to be that way. It's meant to be such that, you know, demagogues or whoever else cannot just simply seize the machinery of government and make it go. It's insured sort of against sin.
Now, when we look at our current situation, as you say in your article, that our civilization is a flower. It was a bud. And it's
yes.
And it's opened up. It hasn't all turned out the way I think that the framers would like to have it had. And it certainly, the ongoing American Revolution, if we could talk about it that way, has not been untinged by a significant amount of secularism. What are your thoughts?
Sure.
There?
No, I think that's right. I think that the idea of the strength of secularism in American society is maybe a little bit overplayed. I think that America is still a very religious country. I think that those appeals to religion and specifically Christianity still matter a great deal in our politics. I honestly think that had not the Supreme Court removed the consideration of abortion effectively from Democratic consideration altogether, that law probably would have been overturned. So I think that we are still highly religious, and certainly so compared to, say, the Western Europeans. So I think that it still matters a great deal in America. Now, on the other hand, are there kind of competing orthodoxies? That is certainly the case. I mean, there certainly is this more kind of secular liberal mindset that accords almost no value at all to the Christian view of the person. And that is the sort of mindset that does things like levy this Health and Human Services mandate on religious organizations. The idea that essentially through coercion, they must force us to kind of take a different view of persons.
So with respect to Iran and the calls for freedom, democracy, and secularism, and you started by saying, and I agree with you, you can understand where the students are coming from because, you know, do they want to continue to live under the constraints of kind of a nationalized Islam?
Yes.
They know from their history what secularism looks like. What is the proper combination that a country like Iran needs?
Well, you know, after I wrote this article, one of my students was he was upset with me because he basically felt like I wasn't offering the students in Iran any answers. Because there they are. They're Muslims, and the only hope for them to have some freedom is to take this secular path. But that's sort of exactly my point. I think that Islam itself basically is kind of a trap for people. I think that there are fundamental flaws to Islam, and that is why it is a religion that does not spread by evangelism, but basically spreads through conquest, spreads through the sword. What I'm saying to the students is, in Iran, is that it's not going to work with Islam, period. You're not going to have freedom. And if you go with secularism, it may gain you freedom from Islam in the public square if you can find a way to kind of cordon it off. But it's not going to gain you that package of kind of dignity, rights, and freedom that you recognize in the West and you want so much, because that package is the product of a culture, of traditions, of Christianity. That comes about in kind of an organic way, and you can't just sort of construct it like on a blueprint and make it kind of will it into existence.
So, and I love the way that you put it. You're borrowing from one of your friends, Louis Marcos,
yes,
where he talks about in the Muslim world, the church is the state. In the French Revolution, the state was the church. You say the third way that our civilization reflects is that the church is the soul. The church is not the state. It's the soul of the system. What
That's
do you
right.
mean by that?
What I mean is that the Jesus, it really comes with Jesus, that the church and the state prior to Jesus, and really for most of human history, the sacred, the secular, it's all bound up in one thing, right? You know, one king, one church, one people, one religion, whatever. It's just one thing. And with him, you have this idea of a separation, and the state has this role. But it is nowhere near as lofty as we think it is. The state's role is actually a limited role. It is not nearly as important as sort of the empire of the spirit, of the soul. And with Christianity, you begin to have that awareness of that. And the separation of church and state, it exists really when Christianity first starts. And then, of course, it begins to exist again later in history. Thanks to conditions in America, really, the way they develop. And what you have is a situation where the church does not rely on the state, it is not funded by the state, the state does not provide it with its parishioners, but instead it is free to function as it should, which is, it is free to call the state to righteousness. It will assist the state when the state is right, it will resist the state when the state is wrong, and it will call the state to righteousness. That's why I say that it's like the soul of the system. The church is sort of like the conscience of the society.
Folks, you can check out Dr. Hunter Baker's book, The End of Secularism, under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Hunter Baker is Associate Dean of Arts and Sciences at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, author of the book, The End of Secularism. He's got a forthcoming publication titled Political Thought, A Student's Guide. He's also written an article for the latest Touchstone magazine titled The Soul of Liberty, Calls for Freedom, Democracy, and Secularism End Up with None of the Above. Dr. Baker, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
When we come back, we are going to mark a sad anniversary, one that is it's hard to even celebrate as an anniversary because it just seems like it just happened. But 1 year ago today, right around the hour that we're speaking, there were a terrible set of storms that passed through the Midwest, and one of them hit Joplin, Missouri, with an incredible loss of life and, of course, paling by comparison, a loss of property ordering in the hundreds of millions. We're going to talk with Glenn Merritt of LCMS World Relief and Human Care 1 year after the Joplin tornado. Stay tuned.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House. cph.org.
The sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come. Join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30 and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois at trinitymillstadt.org.